Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
That was in Forest Hills, Queens. This was in January of 1977. I had killed a woman, and her boyfriend was escaped injury, physical injury.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story. It's not for anybody else, it's for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 12. The 44 Caliber Killer. Act 1. Looking for someone to kill. In January of 1977, after four attempts to kill, only one of which resulted in a homicide, David Berkowitz was dead set, no pun intended, on bringing his quote-unquote losing streak to an end. The attacks, which had been carried out as a sort of misguided attempt to offset the deep-seated feelings of inadequacy he had felt his entire life, had now, due to his perceived failure to murder in a reliable fashion, only intensified. And so, whipped up into a bloodthirsty frenzy focused solely on his own misery, David went out, night after night, desperately looking for the perfect victim. But since it's David Berkowitz, and he is nothing if not conflicted, as soon as he found the perfect victim, while out driving around with the 44 in his pocket, he stopped to help them instead of hurting them.
On one particular evening, he described being out looking for victims and finding what appeared to be an ideal couple who were trapped and at his mercy in a car that was stuck in heavy snow that had fallen that night around the city and suburbs, and approaching them with the full intent of killing them when the young man, the driver of the vehicle, turned and walked toward him, pleading for help. "I'm stuck. Could you please give us a hand here?" And he immediately took his hand off the gun and went to work as David Berkowitz, Good Samaritan, and got the kids unstuck. The guy even offered to pay him, and he declined it. "I'm just happy to help."
This was like in January or February of 1977. Once I was walking up the street, on that same corner where I had killed a person a few hours later, I had helped this guy and his two girls get their car out of the snow. I was walking by, and I had the gun in my pocket. And they asked me, "Hey, can you give us a hand?" Because I was the only one. It was a deserted street, really. And we're stuck. We can't get out. And I looked at these people, and, you know, a guy and two attractive girls. And I said, "All right, yeah, sure." And I helped them. And this guy was a young kid. He was like 18, 19 years old. And I helped him get his car out. They didn't know how to maneuver it out of there.
Jack asked David why he didn't kill them.
"You never thought that time of just turning the gun?"
No, because I wasn't worked up in that state. I didn't want to do that, you know? Because I already met these people. I had contact with them. I saw them as persons. Even for that brief second, I looked at their faces, you know? I couldn't do it like that. I wanted to just help them get out of the snow, and even though they didn't know I had the gun in my pocket.
David says he declined to murder these particular innocent young people because he had come to view them as individuals, not as stand-ins for his rage, but as real people. People that obviously had nothing to do with him or anything he was upset about. Not that he probably had quite that much perspective on it, but he knew he could no longer harm them after they had spoken to him.
In order to kill, he had to see his victims as targets. They had to fit the profile of the image he had of the biological mother in his mind at a younger age that he was killing over and over. If any potential victim at the last minute turned and spoke to him, in most cases, he could not go ahead with the killing.
Jack points out that the teenagers would have been perfect victims.
Sounds like the guy with two girls in the car might have been ideal sort of victims.
They were. I mean, that's why I was trying to show you the irony. It would be, under normal circumstances, the ideal victims. But the guy had come up to me, and a complete stranger, and here I was with dark clothing on a dark street, you know, huddled up. It was 0 degrees that night. And he said to me, could you give me a hand, mister? We're stuck here. And immediately, I just went to help him, you know, without a question asked. You know, I looked at him, and see, he had come to try to befriend me. Well, just to get help, and here I was needed, and now I'm important, you know, I could do something to help. I said to myself, thank God, you know, I mean something to somebody, even if it's just for a second. You know, I'm called upon to help.
David had been called upon to help. And now, as a byproduct, he had been filled with such an intense amount of personal importance that it had, he says, temporarily satiated his need to kill. And while that might be partially true, I wonder if it doesn't have more to do with the fact that since they had approached him, he had lost the element of surprise, and now, in order to kill them, he'd have to confront them first. Confrontation not really being his strong suit, it was something he was unwilling, in fact, unable to do. I mean, really, an inability to confront his thoughts, feelings, or successfully navigate situations he had found himself in throughout his life was really what all of this was about in the first place. And so, these three were off the hook, and he would, instead, momentarily play the good guy, basking in the satisfaction that came along with. But unfortunately, that satisfaction wouldn't last long. Jack asked David about the timing of this event in relation to the fourth attack.
And yet after that, you went on and shot somebody.
Yeah.
That night.
Yeah.
So that wasn't quite enough of a feeling.
No, not just a moment of relief.
When you helped the guy and the two girls, was that right after the third crime?
Actually, no, it was just before the fourth. That very evening was the crime, didn't you see? I had helped them about 10:30 or 11 o'clock or thereabouts, and the crime itself happened a little after midnight.
And how many people did you attack in the fourth crime?
Well, two. One wasn't hurt. The girl was killed, and the guy wasn't hurt, though, at least not physically.
After pushing helpless, trapped young man and woman who otherwise would have been his victims out of a stuck snowbank, he continued cruising the streets and struck again.
A little less than 2 hours after helping three teenagers stuck in the snow, David Berkowitz snuck up on a young man and woman sitting alone in a parked car and shot them. This would be his fourth attack with the 44.
Fourth crime.
That was in Forest Hills, Queens. This was in January of 1977.
This is after you helped the guy that drove his car?
Yeah. I had killed a woman, and her boyfriend was escaped injury, physical injury.
Act 2. Christine Freund and John Deal. On January 29th, 1977, just a few hours before he helped three teenagers out of the snow, Good Samaritan David Berkowitz, restless and agitated, put on a light jacket and jeans, despite an outside temperature of 14 degrees, grabbed the .44, and left the apartment. When he reached his car, he had a hard time starting it, but eventually it turned over. He drove south on the Cross County Parkway, paid a 75-cent toll on the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, and headed once more into Queens. He only had one goal in mind. Quote, "My goal in all these murders and attempted murders was only to kill my victims as quickly and as painlessly as possible. I didn't want to wound them. Aiming for the head was the surest way." End quote. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
Nander and Olga Freund were determined to start a better life for their family. So in 1960, they packed up their two little girls, Christine and Eva, said goodbye to friends and family, and left their native Salzburg for the United States of America and a better life. When they arrived in New York City, Nander found work as a butcher for Trun's Meat, a well-known butcher shop in the greater New York area. They settled in and worked hard, eventually finding a home at 5818 Linden Street in the quiet suburb neighborhood of Ridgewood, Queens. Life in America wasn't easy, and they overcame many hardships, but they stuck with it and persevered. By January of 1977, the fruits of their labor were beginning to show. Their daughters, Christine and Eva, were grown and showing every sign of inheriting that life that Nander and Olga had worked so tirelessly for them to experience over the last 17 years. Christine, now 26, was ambitious like her parents and worked hard. She finished school and returned to Austria for 9 months to work as a bilingual secretary before accepting a position at Reynolds Securities in Manhattan. John Deal, 30 years old, was a bartender at the Ridgewood 3 restaurant on Grandview Avenue, just up the street from the Freunds. John and Christine had been dating for 7 years, and John felt it was time to pop the question, so he made plans to propose on Valentine's Day, but he would never get the chance. On the night of January 29th, 1977, Christine grabbed a heavy coat as she heard the familiar honk of John's blue Pontiac Firebird. She headed down the stairs of her house and quickly dashed through the frigid air into the warm passenger seat of the running car. As they cruised through the streets, they talked about their future plans. Christine saw all the promise in John that she saw in herself, and she encouraged him to leave the bar and start a career of his own. On this particular night, they were on their way to see Rocky, a new movie everyone was talking about, and they were excited to finally get the chance to see it for themselves. They found parking near the Continental Theater and hurried in to see the film. After the movie, they walked down the street to have a drink at the Wine Gallery at the corner of 72nd and Austin. The couple loved the film and discussed it over drinks. Just after midnight, the couple finished their wine, paid the bill, and went outside into the winter night. They headed toward John's car, which was parked around the corner at Station Plaza. As they walked under the overpass of the Long Island Railroad, John held Christine close as their laughter echoed below the train tracks. They took little notice as they passed a man wearing a thin jean jacket headed in the opposite direction. John and Christine turned off Continental Street and through the deserted parking lot. When they reached John's car, Christine stepped into the passenger side and quickly closed the door. John started the car and let it idle for a few minutes to warm up. John leaned over and kissed Christine, then put the car into reverse. Suddenly, the passenger window side exploded. Christine let out a blood-curdling scream as a bullet shot straight through her right temple and another through her neck in rapid succession. A third shot ricocheted off the dashboard, and the man they had seen moments before in the jean jacket was now running away from the car with a gun gripped tightly in his hand. John, in shock but unarmed, pressed himself into the horn at full force and screamed out Christine's name, but she didn't answer. Her body was lifeless, her eyes motionless. The woman whom he had planned to spend his entire life, whom he had just been holding moments before, was silent and still, covered in blood. John got out of the car and ran into the street, desperately searching for help. As he unsuccessfully attempted to flag cars down, he heard the sound of a siren in the distance. The police had received a call from a neighbor who had heard the gunshots, and within minutes they were on the scene. Moments later, an ambulance pulled up. Christine was taken to St. John's Hospital in Queens, but she never regained consciousness and was pronounced dead at 4 a.m. At her side were her parents Nandor and Olga, her sister Eva, and her soon-to-be fiancé, John Deal.
Quote, "I saw them get into the car and I walked up the street. I walked several hundred feet, turned around and headed back to the car they were seated in with the engine running. I aimed and fired. This took about 5 minutes. I don't remember what kind of car it was, a blue something. The engine was running and I just walked up from behind. I aimed for her head, you know, quick and efficient. I guess practice makes perfect. I was able to control the gun physically. After walking up, I stood in front of the window, crouched slightly. I brought the gun up with two hands. I opened fire. Three shots were all I had to use. The glass flew into the car and I hit her. I just wanted to kill her, nothing more. I used only three of the five shells in the gun. There really wasn't any reason to use them all. I knew I had hit her. I had to save my ammunition." End quote. David Berkowitz was now holding the gun properly with two hands, thus, quite unfortunately, improving his accuracy. Quote, "After I shot her, I began to run. I ran to my car. It was quite far away. It meant a long run for me. I ran past the Long Island Railroad and kept on going. I think I heard the car horns blowing, and I think I heard the man get out. He began to scream, but by that time, I was far away." End quote. David Berkowitz had committed his second murder, and he knew it. Quote, "This did result in a homicide to my joy at that time. However, this shooting was different from all the others for two reasons. One, because I used two hands to fire the gun. Two, because I didn't have any fear. This time, when I crept up to the car and fired, I wasn't frightened and I remained calm and cautious. During the fourth shooting, when I used two hands, I guess at this time I had further succeeded in justifying my crimes to myself and that I was more determined than ever. At this point, I imagine I didn't care much anymore, for I had finally convinced myself that it was good to do it, necessary to do it, and that the public wanted me to do it. The latter part I believe until this day. I believe that many were rooting for me. This was the point in which the papers began to pick up vibes and information that something was happening out in the street. After the shooting, I ran to my car and I escaped into the freezing night. The next day, I heard about the death and the police's theory that this recent shooting was connected to several others in the Bronx and Queens. Lastly, I cannot explain my change, a loss of fear, except for the fact that I was growing more cold-blooded daily as my thoughts centered on murder and because my determination was increasing." End quote. Berkowitz had found his confidence, according to him, and along with it, speed and accuracy, the combination of which had resulted in a homicide. And so, it was at this time that the tone of the crimes completely changed. With the killing of Christine Freund, David Berkowitz got his swagger back. And his quote-unquote losing streak had officially come to an end. But that wasn't the only thing that happened. He had also returned to the MO that would become his trademark.
That fit the classic pattern of what he was seeking. These two unfortunate young people in love, embracing in a car after watching a movie and stopping for a drink and getting ready to pull out of a parking lot, were, in his mind, perhaps getting ready to engage in the sort of sexual act he imagined his biological mother engaging in, resulting in his birth as an illegitimate child who was plagued with disturbances and darkness from the earliest memories.
Act 3, Ziegfeld Follies.
Were younger women chosen because of your frustration and trying to deal with women? That's what Abramson said.
But I appreciate it if you don't mention that now.
His sexual urges and all the energy it took to repress those urges was a key part of these explosions, these ejaculations of violence through the barrel of a gun. It's a bigger part than he could ever admit to himself or to a journalist or to a minister or to a psychiatrist even. He's genuinely shamed and embarrassed by his sexual feelings.
Sensing Berkowitz's resistance, Jack digs deeper into the sore spot, hoping to unearth what's buried beneath. To this end, Jack asks David if he ever lived with a woman.
You never lived with a woman at all? I'm just curious.
If you can, you know, I'd appreciate it if you handle it tactfully.
I want to handle all this stuff tactfully. I just want to have enough background so that I can. Yeah. Well, did you live with a woman?
No.
Did you ever want to feel left out because you?
Yeah.
Did you ever approach women and get rebuffed?
Yeah, most guys have, you know, from time to time.
You took it a little bit too personally when you got rebuffed?
Probably. But at the time, I couldn't live with a woman because I had no real stable job. Too many frustrations, you know, paying the bills and having to work in these low-paying jobs, coming home exhausted, working 50, 60 hours a week. No financial security. I couldn't live with anybody.
Did you ever have a desire to get married?
Yeah.
Had you pretty much given up hope of having that sort of relationship, marriage, and family when you started doing the crimes?
Yeah. I figured this is it. I went for broke. I saw no purpose in living or anything. I saw no hope of ever being happy or content.
Berkowitz says that he wanted to live with a woman, get married, and have a family, but that he didn't have enough money, so he gave up on the whole lot and set about killing them instead. If only he had had a better job, didn't have to work so hard, and wasn't so tired at the end of the day, none of this would have happened. I mean, after all, it wasn't something inside himself, but outside of himself, that was to blame. This is how he seemed to feel about it. But maybe saying this was just easier than admitting that he wasn't emotionally equipped, that he hadn't done the necessary self-care or sought the necessary psychological help in order to be emotionally healthy enough to live with a woman, or with anyone for that matter. Of course, cohabitation, marriage, and family was a little cart before the horse when it came to David anyway. I mean, David Berkowitz didn't interact with women on nearly any level. He didn't have female friends, and he certainly didn't have any lovers. In order to ascertain the level to which David did not interact with women, Jack asked David if he ever saw a sex worker in New York as he had while stationed in South Korea.
No.
Why not?
I just never got around to it. I don't know. I got when I worked in Manhattan in the truck yard. They were all over the place down there, 10th Avenue. In the 40s and the 30s, they hung out there, you know. I never did. In the back there, guys coming in with a woman, let us park there, you know, because it's all desolate back there, right along the waterfront, you know. The back was filled up every night, but I never did myself, you know. I don't know why. I could have.
Once he was back in the States, back in his own culture, it is my feeling that the idea of a relationship, even a purely sexual one, came with a lot of baggage. Baggage he had been free of while he was in the military, since it was outside of any kind of norm he could have possibly attached it to. Back in the States, I think he compared any potential relationship with that of his adoptive parents, Nat and Pearl, and held it to that bar. And in the case of Nat and Pearl, who seemingly had, by all counts, a healthy, committed, emotionally meaningful, and productive relationship based on honesty and understanding, a relationship was something Berkowitz had no illusion he would ever be anywhere close to being able to achieve. So he just threw it all away. He didn't even bother. And that goes for sex, too. Self-reportedly, David Berkowitz never saw a sex worker again once he was back in the States. and most likely remain celibate for the rest of his life.
I don't think David ever had sex again after his experiences with prostitutes in South Korea. And I got the impression that those sexual experiences with those women were very unsatisfying to him.
David Berkowitz may have never had sex again, but he was, however, a big fan of porn, and most likely was still a big autoeroticizer, just as he had been while stationed at Fort Knox.
He bought pornographic magazines, it seemed, and that was the extent of his ability to fulfill sexual or romantic fantasies.
He liked porn, but he did seem aware that it only represented one aspect of a relationship, and regarding that, he seemed a little disappointed.
They just seem to be, they don't have any depth to them. A lot of the pornography things I had, and they were hardcore. They just made people seem to be the type that just seek their own pleasure, you know, physical pleasure. When you looked at the pornography, you only see a physical sex act. You don't see any bondage of love or emotions or caring or feeling or anything like this. So it is degrading, you know, to those other people. I mean, I looked at it that way. That these were not really humans, they were just objects. Lustful creatures fulfilling their desires. This is the impression I got.
Okay, went a little off the rails there, wildly leaping from this is only sex to these aren't really people. But I think it serves as a little taste of some of the thinking that got him to the murders. There is no love here, therefore it's pointless. Therefore, the lives of these people are pointless. Therefore, they don't matter. Therefore, they aren't people. Quite a strange step to take, but of course, everything here involves looking around a corner. Most of us, thankfully, will never peer. But of course, peering around that corner was exactly what Jack was there to do in the first place, in an effort to ascertain any semblance of what could possibly be considered a motive. And so, Jack asked David about his anger and how it might relate to pretty young women.
Your anger was, it was pretty much at the world in general, or was it more directed at pretty young women?
I'd say, I don't know, you know, I don't know. At times I was angry at the world, sometimes I'd blame certain people for it. Group of people for my problems, you know, for my adoption and my illegitimate birth and things. I guess I had been more hurt by these people.
Okay, now we're in the pocket. David describes an oscillating center port for his rage, which endlessly wobbles back and forth between the young women he was attracted to and his birth mother. Feeling he was as close to uncovering a clear cause for motive as he ever had been, Jack asked David if he ever thought about his mother while committing the murders.
Did you ever feel like when you were out with the 44, this is my mother?
Yeah. I got to a point where I was so angry at the world, you know, anyone that resembled my mother, really, you know, my biological mother, that I wasn't sorry for what I did, because I felt that they had it coming.
You felt they had it.
Yeah.
Berkowitz says that the young women he murdered, quote, had it coming, due to the fact that they resembled his impression of what his biological mother would have looked like at the time of his birth. And so, in order to gain a little more detail, Jack asked Berkowitz about his perception of his mother at the time of his conception and subsequent birth.
When you were first told about her by your adoptive father, didn't you have an image of a young, beautiful woman?
Yeah, I did.
Lost, tragically lost, mm-hmm. out on life, giving birth to you.
Mm-hmm. And sure, I figured maybe she'd be in her 20s, early 20s or something, you know.
Maybe subconsciously, the women you were shooting were... You were seeing them young, beautiful,
did that reinforce the idea that you had of your mother, maybe?
Yeah, I guess so, you know.
Consciously or subconsciously, he was looking for a young, attractive woman like the one that he had carried in his mind as the image of his biological mother, whom at a very young age, 5 or 6, his adoptive parents had told him was a wonderful, beautiful, attractive, caring woman who had died giving birth to him.
Ever the psychic surgeon, Jack takes Berkowitz back to the beating heart of his mother's sexuality when she was quite young, approximately the same age as some of the women he was shooting. Specifically, he takes him to a photo that David remembered seeing of his birth mother, Betty Falco, when she was a dancer in New York City for the incredibly famous vaudevillian production known as the Ziegfeld Follies. And how Betty, in this picture, closely resembled the women Berkowitz was targeting.
Young, dark-haired women, which is from a photograph maybe he saw of his mother when she was younger and danced with the Ziegfeld Follies. A photograph, I think, he described of his biological mother as a child with her father and a dancing uniform.
Oh, my mother was a dancer. And she used to, my biological mother used to dance in the Ziegfeld Follies in her apartment. They were all pictures of her when she was a young child and about to art. She started dancing when she was 16 or so. And there was a picture of her father, very stern. And I remember it was a big picture, I guess about this big. It fit into one of the big wooden frames with a stand, you know, and an old tech antique. And it was her father sitting in a chair, very stern and serious, you know, and had his arm around my mother with a very short skirt and her hair all, you know, real nice and dancing she was in. Then there were pictures of her with the Ziegfeld Follies, you know.
He described a photo of his mother wearing a dancing costume or outfit as a young girl, very, very pretty and very happy with her father. And for a time, she actually was hired as a dancer, apparently, with the Ziegfeld Follies, which were a pretty big deal back in the day. There was a similarity in his mind between the victims he was seeking and the image of his mother as a young woman, as he envisioned her.
This picture of his birth mother in the glory days of her youth was fixed in Berkowitz's mind. A single, nearly mythical image next to nearly the only representation of her in her prime he had ever seen. And him, it was the perfect setting, the perfect image for the woman that would give birth to him, to be his true mother. A graceful and sexually virulent dancer who commanded the public attention in one of the most famous productions on the planet. But even in this setting, in this photograph of perfection and beauty, there was a foil, as seated beside her was her father, Moishe Broder. And it was clear, at least to David, that there was conflict between the two. Quote, Betty tried to develop her dancing talents and she wanted to continue dancing and go into show business. Supposedly she had a lot of talent. However, her strict father, Mr. Broder, who valued tradition over the needs of his children more than anything else, refused to let her fulfill her desires. He insisted that she remain a homebody, get married, raise kids, fix meals, darn socks, retire to Florida, and eventually die, all according to Jewish tradition, end quote. David fiercely sided with his mother, and Moishe clearly became the villain in the melodrama that David built in his mind around the photo, developing a wholly negative opinion of Betty's father, although they had never met. Quote, that rotten bastard who considered Betty the apple of his eye, his favorite of all her brothers and sisters, refused to loosen his grip on her when he finally died and the grip, while not mentally released, but at least physically released, was loosened, it did Betty no good. By now she was too old to begin a career and life had already passed her by. I believe he passed away in the early 70s, end quote. In a way, in Berkowitz's mind, it's not too far off to say that it was as though Moshe had killed Betty while she was still alive and in the prime of her youth. And for that, doing figuratively what he himself was doing literally, he reviled Moshe with every ounce of his being. And so, at the heart of turmoil and conflict, there was just more turmoil and conflict. And when you combine that with David's frustrated sexual energies rerouted, his biological mother Betty becomes the epicenter for every single ounce of his displaced rage. Anger, rage, sex, pregnancy, lust, and family, all wrapped up into one disturbing little package. And so it is here that we see David's desires converge, his own sexual frustrations fused with the sexuality of his mother, which would ultimately result in his birth, a byproduct of her relationship with David's birth father, Joseph Kleinman.
David Berkowitz was killing his mother over and over again.
Quote, "My mother Falco was sitting in those parked cars with Kleinman, greedy, wild-tempered Kleinman. It was that bastard who I took after. His temper, his impatience. He hated crowds and probably people too." End quote. David's potentially mistaken read on his birth father, Joseph Kleinman, notwithstanding, one thing is for sure. His birth mother, Betty Falco, was sitting securely at the eye of his internal storm.
He saw her as an immoral person who had, for years, exploited men, including married men, who was his biological father, for what she needed to survive, and who did that without moral compunction. She later in life moved in circles of where there were wealthy, primarily Jewish men, and continued right up until the end to look for and exploit older men who had some resources. And his image was that his mother and this guy, Kleinman, were fooling around and she got pregnant, having sex in a car, and that people who do that drive around looking for secluded streets and parks and lovers' lanes where the shootings took place. He could very easily envision any dark-haired woman, particularly who was maybe embracing another person or even happened to be talking to another woman or what they were doing.
And so it was in this way that the parked car on the lover's lanes with David outside violently firing round after round into the vehicle becomes the actual physical meeting place between the height of David's post-war sexual experience, the observation of others, with his mother's sexuality, and as a result, the center point of a rage he no longer sought to suppress.
He just opened fire. I'm killing my mother and this horrible married man committing infidelity to create a wretched creature like me. And I'm eliminating that possibility of another such creature as myself being born. He had this incredible prudish idea about sex. Sex is dirty.
Quote, "Betty never told me that she ever sat in a car or that she was impregnated in a car. But it is true that many unwanted children are brought into this world as a result of careless sexual encounters in automobiles." End quote.
David Berkowitz was stalking and finding in random vehicles and dimly lit porches his mother, killing her over and over again in his mind.
Quote, "I did know why I pulled the trigger. I did know why I deliberately killed. I knew who the person was with whom I wanted to hurt, on whom I wanted revenge. These shootings were planned long before they took place." End quote.
I wanted to yell and scream at her, but I never could never do it. I realized, you know, that was it. This looseness, this lack of maturity and concern, carelessness.
Always willing to play the superior, David is eager to blame his mother, describing her actions as a quote-unquote lack of maturity and concern, all while explaining away his own actions.
Part of the problem was, except for picking fights with other kids when he was very young, he was not capable of confrontation. You know, he didn't have the words to confront somebody, even a woman that he might have been attracted to. It was beyond his ability to even ask her for a date. And any rage that he felt had to be expressed behind people's backs, behind the backs of the people who had caused him anguish or real or imagined grief. So he carried this rage at his inability to even approach a woman in any romantic or sexual way. He felt that that was justified because of the person that his mother had been.
I was too shy to approach my mother and say to her, you know, she's sitting there, you know.
Yeah, if you saw her, you understand what I'm saying. She's so outwardly humble and shy. Oh, please, I'm sensitive. Don't hurt me. I wanted to go up to her sometimes and just scream at her for an hour, you know, and pour everything out to her, all my anger, for all these years, you know, and things. And here I was, just an accident, carelessness, really, you know, her carelessness with her guy, you know. And all the years I went through with these things, but I couldn't do it. I didn't have the guts, or I was too shy to just go up to her and yell at her or something, or scold her, or do anything. I don't know, you know. So instead, I just held it in, and then it wound up going around. You know, like, I'm here and she's there, and I should have approached her directly, but I couldn't. I just held everything in, but then it went around, you understand? And went off into other directions, outwardly. Now, am I making it clear?
Yes, I think you are. Act 4. I think we got a match here, guys.
After 3 shootings, somebody had put together the ballistics from the crime scenes and determined that they were all being fired from the same weapon, and that will, in most cases, mean that they're all being carried out by the same criminal. He was labeled at that time the 44 killer.
A single weapon across multiple homicides meant the police had a quote-unquote psychopath on their hands. And once that got out, it was a media frenzy.
As soon as police linked them to a single weapon, the media started speculating wildly about this lone gunman, looking for other common factors in each of the killings. They played into stereotypes of women as being sexual creatures, particularly young women out at night late, on their way to or from dance clubs or bars with a male partner. And they had all of New York City in a very short time fearing and questioning what was going on. Why were people being shot for no apparent reason? The media began supposedly working with police to try to tease out details and maybe flush this guy into the open. But more than that, the media was exploiting the headline and people's fear, which played right into David's sense that he was doing something significant.
The senselessness of the murders, combined with the social trends of the times, ignited a fear that created a media blitz that was, almost from the very beginning, more attention than David Berkowitz could have possibly ever imagined. And once he realized he liked that, he began to consciously seek it. He also realized he could do things to increase it.
He was looking for shock value, and once the media began covering each crime with explosive headlines and breaking news banners, he realized that the more genteel the neighborhoods that he picked for his killings, the greater the shock value would be.
That's why my crimes created such a shockwave in New York, because I was going into areas where they never had much violent crime. And if they did have a violent crime, it was something once in a while, it was in reference to like a mugging, an armed robbery at a local store, nothing like this. You know, they couldn't deal with this, you see. That's why they had the intense anger against me, the hatred, because they couldn't deal with that. In New York, they're not used to that. And that's why it's important to understand something like this and learn how to deal with it, possibly prevent it.
Going to these quiet, sleepy little neighborhoods.
Yeah.
These more distant kind of clinical assassinations for no plausible reason, that was stunning. That was a shock to everyone. And the fact that no one was safe, they happened in lower middle class neighborhoods, upper middle class neighborhoods, the randomness created such chaos.
It's important to remember that the term serial killer was only beginning to be coined at this time. Even amongst law enforcement, it certainly wasn't part of their daily vernacular. Police, and certainly the vast majority of the public, thought of most, if not nearly all, crimes as coming from a direct and clear causation. But this was something different.
It was a modern-day Jack the Ripper with a .44 caliber gun on the prowl. It was unique in pretty much American crime history at that point.
It caused a degree of public pandemonium never before seen in the city. People, specifically young women, didn't know what to do or how to behave.
Young women began dyeing their hair from dark color to blonde. Anyone who was really careful just stopped going out at all, unless it was in a large group. Several nightclubs had to close down.
And I could only imagine that it fed on a fear that they already had. No longer the vague threat of harm that many, if not most, women faced every day, now they knew they were being targeted. And I don't get the sense that the police had any idea where to start or how to react.
Your mind can go wild if you're walking around New York City streets at night about what could be or who could be around the next corner. They doubled up and tripled up on police protection in certain areas, and it seemed like they always picked the wrong one. He would strike very close by where police had been or within minutes after they had just called off a stakeout outside of a nightclub someplace. It was utter chaos. It was as though he had some kind of supernatural, prescient knowledge about where police would be and how to move around to evade detection. And all the time, he was hiding in plain sight.
Next time on Killer Tape. David's attacks become even more brazen as all the attention and all the press goes to his head.
Okay, fifth crime.
That was also in the Forest Hills, Queens, about 50 feet past the last one. Would be about 5 weeks later.
What were the casualties here?
One woman was killed. She wasn't sitting in a car, she was walking home, and I just shot her.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.